and we near the end, that we could all rise to the challenge of being faithful and being pure unto the end. So this morning, I'm going to jump right into my message. The title this morning is A Call to Purity. In the past, impurity was embarrassing. And really, it still is today. But our world has made impurity much more blatant and open and much less embarrassing than what it was. It was easy for us to be sheltered. It was easy for us to shelter our children and to grow up in a sheltered environment because most of our backgrounds were sheltered from those kinds of things, the impure things around us. But as the world gets wickeder, these things of impurity become more and more bold and forward into our faces every day. And I trust that our homes do not have these things in them. However, because of mail and because of internet, these things can creep into our homes, and we have to be on our guard. We have to watch out for these things. So let's turn to 2 Samuel chapter 11. I want to look at two accounts this morning of men that failed. 2 Samuel chapter 11. We all know this story very well of David, story of David and Bathsheba, but I'm just going to read through it. Starting in verse 1. We're going to read through this, and then we're going to look at it, kind of pull the chapter apart verse by verse, and look at what led up to David's failure. Verse 1, "And it came to pass, after the year was expired, at the time when kings go forth to battle, that David sent Joab and his servants with him, and all Israel, and they destroyed the children of Ammon and besieged Reba. But David tarried still at Jerusalem. And it came to pass in an eventide that David arose from off his bed and walked upon the roof of the king's house. And from the roof he saw a woman washing herself, and the woman was very beautiful to look upon. And David sent and inquired after the woman, and one said, 'Is not this Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite?' And David sent messengers and took her, and she came unto him, and he lay with her, for she was purified from her uncleanness. And she returned unto her house. And the woman conceived and sent and told David and said, 'I am with child.' And David sent to Joab, saying, 'Send me Uriah the Hittite.' And Joab sent Uriah to David. And when Uriah was come unto him, David demanded of him how Joab did, and how the people did, and how the war prospered. And David said to Uriah, 'Go down to thy house and wash thy feet.' And Uriah departed out of the king's house. And there followed him a mess of meat from the king. But Uriah slept at the door of the king's house with all the servants of his lords, and went not down to his house. And when they had told David, saying, 'Uriah went not down unto his house,' David said unto Uriah, 'Camest thou not from thy journey? Why then didst thou not go down into thine house?' And Uriah said unto David, 'The ark and Israel and Judah abide in tents, and my lord Joab and the servants of my lord are encamped in the open fields. Shall I then go into mine house and eat and drink and to lie with my wife? As thou livest and as thy soul liveth, I will not do this thing.' And David said to Uriah, 'Tarry here today also, and tomorrow I will let thee depart.' So Uriah abode in Jerusalem that day and the morrow. And when David had called him, he did eat and drink before him and made him drunk. And at even when went out to lie on his bed with the servants of his lord, but went not down to his house. And it came to pass in the morning that David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it by the hand of Uriah. And he wrote in the letter, saying, 'Set ye Uriah in the forefront of the hottest battle, and retire ye from him, that he may be smitten and die.' And it came to pass when Joab observed the city, that he assigned Uriah unto a place where he knew that valiant men were. And the men of the city went out and fought with Joab, and there fell some of the people of the servants of David, and Uriah the Hittite died also. And we will leave off reading there. Of course, we know the rest of the story. We're not going to look at the rest of the story. We're just going to start here at the beginning. And I just want to take this chapter apart and see what happened here. What actually took place here with David. So first of all, in verse 1, David was at Jerusalem when he was supposed to be where? He was supposed to be in battle. He was not where he belonged. Right off the bat, he's already not doing what he's supposed to do. And I don't know why this happened. This, we can only assume why David stayed back. Maybe he was feeling powerful and he didn't feel like it was necessary for him to be out. He had men that could fight for him. All that to say, he still belonged in the battle. That was his post. In verse 2, it says, "It came to pass in an eventide that David arose from off his bed." What was David doing getting out of bed in the evening? First of all, there's a lot that could be assumed here. And I can't say exactly what was happening that David was getting out of his bed in the evening. But some of the things that I could assume, either he was in bed all day when he should have been out in battle, and he was only getting up in the evening, or he didn't work hard that day, and he went to bed, and he couldn't sleep, and so he got back up. Either one could be a fair assumption, I believe, for this story. David was not tired. He was getting up, and he arose out of bed, and he walked on the roof of his house. It says he walked on the roof of the king's house. And from this roof, he looks down, and he sees a woman washing herself. And there's a lot that could be said about the woman washing herself. What was she doing out where David could see her? There was probably something not right there. Maybe she thought that all the men were off at battle and the king wasn't around, and so she thought she was safe. Maybe she was just sloppy. I don't know. We're not going to get real into that, but there could be things said there. But this is where David went wrong. David saw the woman, or this is another place where David went wrong. He saw the woman, and what should he have done? He should have stopped right there and went back in his house and walked away. But he didn't. He took that second look, and he watched her until this lust started to grow in his heart. And this lust turns into an inquiry. Who is this woman? And it makes me wonder when I read this. This was David walking on top of his own house. He said he was walking on the king's, on his own roof. And most of us know who our neighbors are. And I'm assuming, once again, it's just an assumption, that David already knew who his neighbors were. And he may have already known who this woman was. But there again, it's just an assumption. But he inquired of her as if he didn't know. And it says in verse 3, one said, "Is not this Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite?" Asked it in a question as if, well, don't you know? This Uriah the Hittite, if we know who this man is, he is one of David's valiant men. He is not just some passerby that happened to be living in town for a short period. This is one of David's valiant men. He is named among, is it the 37 of David's valiant men. So I would assume that David knows Uriah well. And there are times even possibly that David and Uriah with their wives had gotten together. And so obviously I'm making a lot of assumptions here. I don't know all these things. I'm just saying these things because the way this story turns out, it looks like some of these assumptions could possibly have been there. And the way the story ended, it's very likely that some of these things could have been there. Even if they weren't, it's the type of thing that happens in the hearts of men today that lead them to their destruction. Well, obviously, we know the story. David calls her to his house. The woman comes, and they spend the night together, and she conceives and has a child. And now David is caught. So David has to figure his way out of this one. And so what does he do? He calls Uriah to come home from the battle, and his goal is to have Uriah spend a couple days with his wife, to maybe try to cover up, make it look like it's not his child. And Uriah, being an upright man that has plugged himself into the people of God, would not take pleasure with himself or his wife while the rest of his men were out fighting and living in tents and living in hard times. He would not do it. So he does not cooperate with David's plan. And David's plan was a very evil one, unknown to Uriah. I don't think Uriah knew at this time what David actually had in mind. So since that didn't work, David comes up with another plan, and he sends Uriah back to battle with a message to his supervisor, Joab, and tells him to put Uriah in the hottest battle to eliminate this man, get rid of him. What a terrible and dark time for the people of God, that David would stoop to such low dealings with his own people. But in order to keep himself clear, he felt as though he had to keep cover for his sin. So one sin led to another and then another. And the way this thing finally gets exposed, which we did not read, was the prophet Nathan comes to David and makes up this story about the man that took his neighbor's sheep, and when he had a whole bunch of his own and all that. We know the story. And right away, David wants to pronounce the whole full judgment on this man. And that's where David's sin finally gets exposed. So maybe we could look at what David could have done to prevent this. First of all, if David had been in battle, he wouldn't have been at home. It wouldn't have happened. He wouldn't even have been in the line of temptation in this way. Even if David had stayed home and was working hard, maybe he stayed home for a good reason. If he was staying home and working hard, he would have gone to bed and would have been tired and wouldn't have been looking around at the neighbors. And if David would have disciplined, as Job said, he made a covenant with his eyes. If David would have made a covenant with his eyes, he would have never taken the second look, and he would have went about his life the way he should have, and ignored and put away the lust from his life. All right, so that's the first account. Let's go to Proverbs 7 and look at the other account. Proverbs chapter 7. And once again, I think we'll read the whole chapter. Proverbs chapter 7, verse 1. This is Solomon speaking as a wise man, speaking to his son. It says, "My son, keep my words and lay up my commandments with thee. Keep my commandments and live as the law, and my law as the apple of thine eye. Bind them upon thine fingers and write them upon the table of thine heart. Say unto wisdom, thou art my sister, and call understanding thy kinswoman, that they may keep thee from the strange woman, from the stranger which flattereth with her words. For at the window of my house I looked through my casement, and beheld among the simple ones, I discerned among the youths a young man void of understanding, passing through the street near her corner, and he went the way to her house, in the twilight, in the evening, in the black and dark night. And behold, there met him a woman with the attire of an harlot, and subtle of heart. She is loud and stubborn, her feet abide not in her house. Now is she without, now in the streets, and lieth in wait at every corner. So she caught him and kissed him, and with an impudent face said unto him, I had peace offerings with me, this day I have paid my vows. Therefore came I forth to meet thee, diligently to seek thy face, and I have found thee. I have decked my bed with coverings of tapestry, with carved works, with fine linen of Egypt. I have perfumed my bed with myrrh, aloes, and cinnamon. Come, let us take our fill of love until the morning. Let us solace ourselves with loves. For the goodman is not at home. He has gone a long journey. He hath taken a bag of money with him, and will come home at the day appointed. With her much fair speech she caused him to yield. With the flattering of her lips she forced him. He goeth after her straightway, as an ox goeth to the slaughter, or as the fool to the correction of the stocks. Till a dart strike through his liver, as a bird hasteth to the snare, and knoweth not that it is for his life. Hearken unto me now, therefore, O ye children, and attend to the words of my mouth. Let not thine heart decline to her ways, go not astray in her paths. For she has cast down many wounded, yea, many strong men have been slain by her. Her house is the way to hell, going down to the chambers of death. This passage here, I feel like, is a little bit more pertinent to us today. Not necessarily that we are looking or we are seeing women walking on the streets that are coming after us and chasing us down, but there are many things that are happening today that are very similar to that. And let's just take a look at that. First of all, I want to look at this chapter and just go through like we did the last one, look at each verse. It says in verse 1, "My son, keep my words and lay up my commandment with thee." This is Solomon speaking to his son. And dads, I think this is important that we address our sons in this way, as a father to his son. "My son, listen to me. I've lived in this world longer than you have, and I have some things I need to tell you." It's okay to say that, and we need to say that to our sons, because our sons, how many of us think of wisdom in a 14-year-old, 14 to 18, how many of us think that there's much wisdom there and understanding? Usually if we go for wisdom, we go to the fathers and the aged men, the older men. It's a rare thing to find a young man that's full of wisdom. And something I wanted to say on that, the young men that are the ages of, young men up to 18, 21, whatever the age is, those men, if they have wisdom, it's because they were taught. It is not because they have experience and they know. And so that is something where the mothers can step in and they can teach their young men. Teach their young men. And the fathers, teach your young men that they can be men full of wisdom, so that when they do come into contact with the world and the lusts that are in the world, they are ready in their experience. And they're not like this simple one that had no understanding, had no idea what he was getting into. So Solomon addresses his son as "my son." Let's address our children as a parent to the son, to the daughter. Teach them. "I am your father, you are my son." This automatically puts you as a father in a position of authority over your son. He says, "Keep my commandments and live, and my law as the apple of thine eye. Bind them upon thy fingers and write them upon the table of thine heart." The apple of your eye. What is the apple of your eye? That's, when I think of the apple of your eye, I've heard one description as that it's the black part of your eye. It's something that's very precious to you. It's also, we often think of the apple of your eye as something that your eye is attracted to. When you look at a picture or you look at something, it's something that is you're drawn to. It's something that's important to you. It doesn't go unnoticed. Keep my law as that thing, the apple of your eye. Bind them about your fingers. If you tie a string around your finger, you tie something around your finger, you may forget it. But when you go to use your hands and you see that thing on your finger, you will remember, oh yes, my dad's law. It's there. It's on my finger. What did he tell me? And it says, write them upon the table of your heart. I get the picture of God with the Ten Commandments etching his finger into the stone. Can we take our hammer and our chisel and write these things in stone? Write the teachings that our father and our mother have taught us as young people. Etch those things in the stone tables of our heart so that they are there forever. They are there even after we're dead and gone. They're still written in our hearts, that we would not forget those things, so the next generation can see the things that we have written on our hearts. Call wisdom your sister, and call understanding your kinswoman. Your sister and your kinswoman, somebody that's related to you, somebody that's precious to you, somebody that you care about. And why is he saying this? It says, to keep thee from the strange woman with which flattereth with her words. Verse 7, it says, he looks through, this is Solomon, looking out of his house, looking through his casement. And in Solomon's house, I assume there was probably some kind of a open window with some kind of slats or something over, and he was looking through the slats that from afar off you couldn't see in, but if you get up close and you look down through, you can see through. He's looking through his casement, and he looks out in the street, and he beholds and he sees the simple ones. Who are the simple ones? In this case, it was the young men. He says, I discern among the youths a young man void of understanding. So this young man was with a group. He was with the youths. Maybe some of those other youth had understanding and did not go with the woman. Maybe they were all a bunch of foolish young people that were hanging out near her corner to see what might happen. It's important who our friends are, because they will take us up or down. Verse 8 says, passing through the street near her corner, and he went the way to her house. What's he doing near her corner? Does he know she's there? And those are questions that we don't know. But he was passing through her corner. In the twilight, in the evening, in the black and dark night, men love darkness rather than light. And they do their wickedness and their evil deeds in darkness where people can't see it. Because their deeds are embarrassing. It says, behold, there met him the woman with the attire of an harlot and subtle of heart. This verse would give the impression that a harlot wears special clothing. There's clothing that she wears that sets her apart, that makes you know who she is. She is loud and stubborn. Her feet abide not in her house. She is without in the street. She lieth in wait at every corner. This is not the Proverbs 31 woman that looks well to the ways of her household, or the Titus 2 woman that is the keeper at home. Those women will not be out here. So she caught him and kissed him, and with an impudent face said unto him, I have peace offerings. This woman is very forward. She's not quiet. She's not under her husband. She's out trying to seduce men, trying to attract a man to her, trying to ruin the lives of men. She goes down through. This woman actually is religious. It says, this day I have paid my vows. She probably was at the temple and did her duty that day. And she appeals to his senses. She's decked her bed with coverings of tapestry. His sight works with fine linen of Egypt. His feeling perfumed my bed with myrrh, aloes, and cinnamon. She's appealing to his sense of smell. And this looks very attractive. She invites him to come with her and spend the night with her. And then verse 19, this is a horrible verse. It says, for the good man is not at home. He has gone a long journey. The good man, who is the good man? In this case, the good man is her husband. This is already a married woman. This is an adulterous situation. And it says, with her much fair speech, and I believe it's much more than just much fair speech. It's her much fair speech, it's her attire, it's her way of handling. It's all these things come together. She forced him. She's talked nice to him. She told him that he was the one she was looking for. Is that true? She was looking for anybody that would come along. Verse 22, it says, he goeth after her straightway as an ox goeth to the slaughter, as a fool to the correction of the stocks. And I believe this is where, he's already made a lot of mistakes up to this point. He should have been at home. He should not have been out in the streets. But he's gone this far, and then he gets to this point where now he needs to make another decision, and he follows her. And I'm assuming the things that are going through his mind are, this does look like fun. This will be an enjoyable evening. And it surely isn't as bad as what it could possibly be. It's just not that bad. He's reasoning with himself. And his reasoning is overpowered by his own passions and his own drives. It says he does not know that it is for his life. He goes after her straightway as the ox goeth to the slaughter. I get the picture of butchering a steer. You might withhold feed from him for a day or two, and it's time for the slaughter to happen. And you come to the trough, the feeding trough. You bang a bucket against the feeding trough. Maybe you'll even dump some feed in the trough. And the ox is out there grazing peacefully. He sees you coming, and he comes running in. For what? He thinks he's coming for feed. He thinks he's coming for something that will satisfy his desires. But what does he get? He gets an instrument of death. And that's what's happening here. It says he is as the ox that goeth to the slaughter, or as a fool to the correction of the stocks. Verse 23, to a dart strike through his liver, as a bird hasteneth to the snare, and knoweth not that it is for his life. If the bird knew that there was a net, would it fly into it? Of course not. If the ox knew that it was going to get a bullet instead of a bucket of feed, would it come in? No. Why did the bird go to the snare? Or why did the ox go to the feeding trough to the slaughter? It's because he didn't know. He didn't have understanding. And of course, an ox or a bird will never have that understanding. They were programmed to do what God has them to do, and that's pretty small. They don't have a lot of decisions to make. But we do. We do. We can make these decisions. We can see these things and avoid them and stay away from them. It says, till a dart strike through his liver. How long can a man live with a dart striking through his liver? Not very long. It's a slow and painful death. Verse 24 says, hearken unto me now, therefore, O ye children, and attend to the words of my mouth. Let not thine heart decline to her ways, and go not astray in her paths. For she has cast down many wounded, yea, many strong men have been slain by her. Her house is the way to hell, going down to the chambers of death. While it looks so good, while your passions are raging and you want to go with her, you have to remember that her house is the way to hell. If we turn one chapter over to chapter 9, verse 18, it says, but he knoweth not that... let's go to 16. Whoso is simple, let him turn in hither, and as for him that wanteth understanding, she saith unto him, stolen waters are sweet, and bread eaten in secret is pleasant. But he knoweth not that the dead are there, and that her guests are in the depths of hell. This woman is a powerful woman. We talked about powerful woman the last time I preached. This is a type of woman that is also very powerful. She is a very evil woman, and she can even cause strong men to fail. None of us are exempt from these kinds of temptation. Chapter 2, verse 17 through 19, it says, none return thither that take hold. Okay, let's just turn there. I don't have it written down right. Proverbs chapter 2, verse 7 and 8. 17 and 18. Which forsaketh the God of her youth, and forgetteth the covenant of her God, for her house inclineth unto death, and her paths unto the dead. None that go unto her return again, neither take they hold of the paths of life. I want to just point out here that this is a proverb, and that proverbs are wise sayings. And not just because it's a proverb doesn't mean it absolutely will happen. But this one says, none that go unto her return again. We're very thankful for the blood of Christ that there is a way out. But in most cases, none that go unto her return again, neither take hold of the paths of life. And even those that are redeemed by the blood of Christ, they often carry scars for life because of doing these types of sins. So this is the harlot of Solomon's day, and I believe there are harlots just the same as this today. But most of us probably do not even know where they're at, or we know enough to stay away that we don't find them. We would be too embarrassed to even get close to her. However, there are ways this harlot can come to us that are more subtle ways than a woman that actually comes to you as a physical person and talks to you. Years ago, it used to be, and it still is today, magazines in the store, whether it be the a local gas station or your Walmart or your grocery store, people would buy them, and because of the embarrassment of owning that thing, they might look at it for a while and they'll throw it out the window and it'll lay along the road. And then some poor soul passerby will come along and pick it up. We ought not to pick those things up. And if we do, we pick them up to trash them, to destroy them. In the past, it was theaters. And I think there's still theaters today. I'm sure none of us go to the theaters to see these types of things. But they were replaced by in-home movies and things like that. So we can do this sin in the privacy of our own home that nobody can see it. And of course, we all know that the internet and cell phones, all those things are dangerous things where the harlot can come to us in those things as well. On warm summer days, the beaches and the swimming pools are places that I don't believe the women that are there are necessarily intentional harlots, but they can cause a man to fail. Of course, we need to be careful with news articles and billboards. These things, undress and immorality is being bombarded on us on every side. It's being pushed in on us, and we have to be aware of these things and know that we are going to take a deliberate stand, take deliberate action to keep ourselves pure, or we will not be pure. We will not be pure without taking action. Purity does not happen by chance. And one thing I want to just make note as we talk about this, we do not need to feel condemned if we happen to come along something that was wrong. If you see something, if you see some kind of thing on a billboard or in your workplace or someplace where you find yourself put in a bad situation, you don't have to be condemned if you see something. By the grace of God, you can say, God, to purify my mind and put your mind to diligent things. But if you see something and you take the second look and you stop and you look at it for a while, that's where it becomes sin. And that's where you do need to feel the guilt of sin. You can't help when a bird flies over your head, but you can help it from making a nest in your hair. Just an example I thought of from my own life. There's this company that, in working for Zimmerman's as a mechanic, that there's a company that I used to work for quite a bit. I'd get out in their job sites, and they had these trucks where they would make these warehouse sites, and they had rented tractors from us, and I'd get into some of their other equipment sometimes to help them out. And one specific instance that I remember is I had to get into the cab of a truck to work on an air conditioner or start the engine or something. I don't remember exactly what I was in there for. But the cab of this truck had pictures all over it. It was one of those little calendars that it was a different woman for each month of the year. And these things were tore off and spread all through the cab of this truck. And so I was faced with the decision. What was I going to do? Well, I had to be in the truck if I was going to fix it. And so in order to keep my mind and heart pure, I had to clean that truck cab out before I could work. had to flip all those things over, put them where I couldn't see them, and then pray and ask God to cleanse my mind and keep my thoughts pure. And I can testify that, thank the Lord, I was able to do that and keep my mind pure. And yet, it would have been a perfect opportunity for temptation to set in and to fail, because I was all alone. There was no workers there. My wife wasn't there. Nobody was there. I could have sat there and indulged for a good amount of time. Thank the Lord, He spared me and gave me victory over that. And there's other stories I could tell of places that I've had to be in through work, that you have to make those decisions to be pure. That I didn't go to that job knowing that was going to be there. I was going to that job knowing I had to fix something that maybe was beyond my abilities, or something that I wasn't sure if I knew what I was doing. And I get there, and I'm a little bit tense because, you know, I'm going into this big construction site, and there's all these all this big equipment and people that seem to know what they're doing, and official-looking people. I was not thinking about purity and those kinds of things. I was thinking about my job. And that's when the devil can easily get a hold of you, is when there's a surprise like that. And it would just feel good to indulge for just a minute, maybe two, maybe five. Okay, moving on. I want to just take a look at a few things out of these two passages that we read here. Things that lead up to failure. In the Proverbs 7 chapter, of course, we looked at the young man was void of understanding. That is something that we need to be diligent about. We need to have understanding. And parents, that's where it's our job to give understanding to our young people. Also, young people, it's our job to go to our parents and ask and be ready and be prepared for the time when you will find things that are wrong and evil. That is a warning sign. If you are void of understanding, ignorance is not bliss. Another warning sign is idleness. If you have too much time on your hand, too much free time, that you are not doing something productive. In Ezekiel chapter 16, verse 49, the sin of Sodom was abundance of idleness. That's one of the sins reported there, one of the biggest sins. They had abundance of idleness. And that caused them the sins that they are well known for today. David, when he was walking around on his housetop, he had idle time. He wasn't diligent. He wasn't in battle. He was idle. Oftentimes when we're idle, we don't sleep as well at night. It says in Ecclesiastes, the sleep of a laboring man is sweet. Much physical labor will make you tired. When you hit the bed at night, you will fall asleep. It's good for us as men to work hard, both young and old. Make our bodies tired so that when we go to bed, we sleep, and that sleep can be sweet and rewarding. It will save you from failure. So what can I do? Proverbs 6:20 says, keep my father's commandments and forsake not mother's laws. Parents, do we have clear commandments? Do our children know our laws? Do we have laws that our children know? Keep my mind and body busy with hard work. Be purposeful about the things that we do. Proverbs 4:15. It says, avoid it, pass not by it, turn from it, and pass away. If you know where the town swimming pool is, go the long way. If you got to go out around it, avoid that thing. Don't come close to it. Let's turn to Galatians 5:16. This I say then, walk in the Spirit, and ye shall not fulfill the lust of the flesh. For the flesh lusteth against the Spirit, and the Spirit against the flesh. And these are contrary one to the other, so that ye cannot do the things that ye would. But if ye be led of the Spirit, ye are not under the law. Now the works of the flesh are manifest, which are these: adultery, fornication, uncleanness, lasciviousness, and it goes on there. Just leave off there. We need to walk in the Spirit. Let's turn to Revelation chapter 12. This is the one I want. Verse 11. Revelation 12, verse 11. How do we overcome? When we have temptations, as men, we do have temptations. Let's not deny it. Even if we are strong, we do have temptations. Revelation 12, 11. And they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb. This is talking about the dragon, but I believe this can still be applied in this as well. It says, they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony, and they loved not their lives unto the death. How do we overcome? First of all, we need to have the blood of Christ applied to our lives so that we are washed of sins that are in our lives. Wash these things away. And then it says, by the word of their testimony, testify of the things that God has done for you. There's something powerful about sharing your personal testimony with somebody else that solidifies in your own mind what God has done for you. If you go around telling people about the wonderful things God has done for you and what He's forgiven you of, it's hard to go back and do those evil things again. Just by the blood of the Lamb, by the word of their testimony, and they love not their lives unto death. We need to not love our lives. We need to put our lives and our bodies into subjection to the Spirit. We need to not love our lives. We need to be willing to lay down our lives for truth. First John 1:9, it says, if we confess, He will forgive. Luke 12:2, there is nothing covered that shall not be revealed. Matthew 5, verse 8, blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. What if you are not pure in heart? Will you see God? I believe we could turn that verse around, and if you are not pure in heart, you will not see God. 1 Corinthians 10:12, wherefore let him that thinketh he standeth take heed lest he fall. Maybe we think we're strong this morning, and praise the Lord if you are, but take heed lest ye fall. I get the picture of a construction site where young men are all over the roof putting on shingles and working hard, working quickly. They want to get done. Maybe the rain's coming. They're quick. They avoid putting on their safety harnesses because they've done this many, many times. And some of you know what I'm talking about. It says, wherefore, let him that thinketh he standeth take heed lest he fall. It just takes a little bit of sawdust or one wrong move and you can fall. Let's turn to Hebrews chapter 3, verse 12 and 13. Hebrews chapter 3. Verse 12, take heed, brethren, lest there be in you, in any of you, an evil heart of unbelief in departing from the living God. Okay, going on to verse 13. But exhort one another daily while it is called today, lest any of you be hardened through the deceitfulness of sin. What does it mean to be hardened through the deceitfulness of sin? I believe what happens when we're talking about the sin of lust and the lust of the eyes and our passions as men, as these things are real battles to us, we can have ourselves deceived in thinking we are walking with God. We can sin today and say, God, please forgive me. And Maybe we sinned last week and we said, God, please forgive me. Maybe we sinned the week before and we said, God, please forgive me. And a month ago, maybe we sinned and we said, God, please forgive me. And that becomes a pattern that we think we can sin, or we don't prepare and we don't think ahead that what will I do if I get faced with this temptation? We fail again and again, and we think the grace of God will cover. God, please forgive me. And He does. But if we make a pattern of that, there will come a point where we are hardened. That is not the grace of God. That is not God forgiving us. God will not forgive that kind of sin and that kind of a pathetic little confession. We need to get serious. If we continue to sin again and again, we are hardened through the deceitfulness of sin. This person is deceived. This person is hardened by the deceitfulness of sin, and this person is not pure. What must we do? If your eye offend you, pluck it out and cast it from you. If your hand offend you, cut it off. I don't think God actually means for us to go and pop our eyeball out of our head or cut our hand off with an axe. But I think it's a figure of speech where if it's that swimming pool in town that you keep passing by that causes you to fail, avoid it. If it is the internet on your device, eliminate it. Throw it away. If it's buying magazines or even just looking at magazines that are for sale, don't go in the store. Avoid it. You're doing this not because you're keeping yourself from some pleasure that would be enjoyable or okay to have. You're not doing it for those reasons. You are doing it because it's to save your life. Sharing with someone, keeping yourself accountable to God and man. If you're serious about finding accountability, it's not your partner's problem. Find somebody that you can share with, but then keep yourself accountable to them. That will help. If you find somebody to share with and you say, I'd like to keep myself accountable to you, don't expect that it's that person's problem to come back to you. It's your problem to continue going back and sharing. And yes, as being our brother's keeper, let's do what we can. If somebody comes to us and says, help me to be pure, keep me accountable, let's go back and talk to the person that wants to have accountability. But those of us that struggle and we want accountability, do your part. Keep yourself accountable. You're doing it for your life. In ministry, it may mean that you let somebody else witness to the woman that's not dressed properly. It may not be your place to do that. Psalm 101, verse 3, it says, I will set no wicked thing before my eyes. Make a deliberate choice that you will set no wicked thing before your eyes. It's your choice. Nobody else can keep you pure. It is your choice. Proverbs 20, verse 17, bread of deceit is sweet to the man, but afterward his mouth shall be filled with gravel. It may look fun for a time, but in the end, it's destruction. Job 31, verse 1, he says, I have made a covenant with mine eyes. Why then should I think upon a maid? There's a lot more verses and places we could go with this, but I think I'm just going to leave off there and just keep your mind stirred up that as we go about our daily lives, that we take deliberate thought and action into keeping ourselves pure, because one day we will see God if we are pure. Do we want to see God one day? Do we want to meet God with a pure heart? I believe we do. And this message, I feel, is more focused on the men, but I believe for the women as well, there's things that the women can be pure in as well. There's many areas, and I'm not going to get into a lot of that today. But let's keep our minds and our thoughts pure and our bodies so that when Christ comes, we can return with joy and go and see Him and live with Him. Why don't we all kneel for prayer? Our Father in heaven, we thank you for this Sunday morning you've given to us. Thank you for once again giving us the changing of the seasons and the rain and giving us a warm, dry place to worship and to learn from you. Thank you for your word to us. I pray, Lord, that each one of us would meet you right where we're at, and that if there's anything with impurity in any of our thoughts, in our minds, in our eyes, in our actions, the things that we do, I pray that we would be pure. I pray that you would convict, help us to not be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin, but that we would have soft hearts and open to your word, that we could be found a spotless bride waiting for that great day when you will come to see us. Pray that you would meet each one where they're at, and pray that we would all go on rejoicing and serving you with all of our hearts. In Jesus' name, amen.